Hello, everybody. Do you love bedtime stories that spark the imagination? Bed Critters is the delightful children's book that brings crazy creatures and sleepy time magic to life. Now available on Amazon. Just search Bed Critters or look for it wherever you buy books.
So, we come into part five called Pivots. They are producing other people's games, one called Love Doppelgangers, which will not actually end up being called Love Doppelgangers because everyone agrees that's a terrible name. For these two guys, Simon and Ant, who are a couple, and they are making a high school zombie shooter game with Unfair. They end up naming it Counterpart High. Huge success, outsells every other game they've made. Sadie calls Dove again because this relationship goes on. I think part of the reason is that it shows us that Sadie is moving forward with Dove in a way that is not baggagey. I think that underpins for us that the issue of the note on the disc is a key that unlocks a door that lets a lot of smaller resentments coalesce into one big thing and rush through that door more so than it is the actual belief Sadie has that, like, Sam set her up.
Yes, I agree with that. Because she is able to separate the emotional things with Dove. There's a line when he allows her to use Ulysses for Ichigo that says she's bound herself to Dove professionally for the rest of her career.
Yeah.
And she's able to make that separation with Dove. And like with Sam, she cannot.
She also talks with Dove about things that are real. Like when she calls him this time, she calls to ask him how to deal with public failure.
Yeah.
Like with her failed game from both sides. And Dove really boosts her up, says all kinds of kind things, celebrates her brilliance again. Sadie is helping her sister around this time plan her wedding. I don't remember if that factors into anything or if it's just...
it's just there.
Some side stuff to fill some pages. Okay, so Marx has broken up with Zoe again. And the two of them were supposed to go to Tokyo, where Marx's parents live. Marx is Japanese. Sadie goes with him instead, platonically, right? I've never been to Tokyo. I should get out of town. I'm mad at Sam. I just had this public failure, as she sees it, a public failure. So she goes with Marx to Tokyo. So while they are in Tokyo, having a nice time, they visit Marx's mother. They visit his father. They visit some of his old friends from high school. Marx has a dream about turning Mapletown into an MMORPG. There might be an abbreviation for how gamers say that. I don't know what it is. But an MMORPG is a massive multiplayer online role-playing game.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what that's called. Yeah.
So from Tokyo, they call Sam. Sam likes the idea. Sadie agrees he likes the idea. Sadie and Marx go out with Marx's high school friends. And at least one of them is a girl who talks about how she was in love with Marx and dated him, and she tells Sadie, don't ever get involved with him. And Sadie's like, I wouldn't worry about that. And then we have another one of those lines where the narration just gives us a nudge and a wink, and it goes, but Sadie Green was a gamer. It's weird that the narration has broken into this commentary on the characters.
Yeah, no, it is that little, like, side, that little gem.
It's the
gem aside from the office again, yeah.
But Sadie Green was a gamer, which lets us know that it's not just narration of, like, Sadie was a gamer and was used to these things. It's the ah. The ah is a personal, mm-hmm. like, affectation in the way you speak.
It's talking to us again.
Yes, it's talking to us. And I think that's annoying.
We also...
it's annoying that it isn't consistent and that it just pops up every now and again. And it took me out of the book every time it happened. Anyway.
She and Marx go to Nezu. I'm very probably saying that incorrectly. But it's temples that has, like, a series of gates, and he is waiting for her at the end. So she's going through all of these gates, and Marx tells her, like, you should walk through them, like, alone, and you'll feel better when you come through them. And it's meditative. It's an experience to do this in Japan. And when she gets to the ends of the gates, he's waiting for her. And on page 235, in reference to the gates, we have again a gate and a gate and a gate.
Yeah.
We have that little callback. This is one of the places that shows up. I think I found three or four.
Well done.
Throughout the book.
So while they're there, they decide to sleep together. Mostly just because they're traveling together and they're in nice hotels and they're like, what else we got to do? They both play it cool. It's just a thing to do while they're in Tokyo. So they get back from LA and what is it? They're waiting for bags in LAX. And Marx's comes first and he has a meeting that he's supposed to be at. So he takes off. And when Sadie's bag comes off second to last and she starts to wheel it out, Marx shows back up and is there waiting for her with his car. And this mirrors a scene she saw outside one day outside the office of, speaking of Simon and Ant, Simon wheeling Ant's bag into the car for him or like off to wherever they were going. And she had noticed that and been like, I wish I could get in a relationship where somebody just did that kind of automatic kindness because they love me. So we have this moment where Marx comes back to the gate and waits for her, blows off his meeting, takes her bag and wheels it out to his car for her. And so they're a couple now. They hide it from everyone, but on the night of the Mapletown launch, Sam sees them and feels hurt. And it turns out that he is totally in love with Sadie himself. And he's upset that Mark's got her and that he never made a move and that he never did anything. He talks about it with his grandfather, who tells him to pivot, which is where the title of this comes from. Also, they're pivoting to MMORPGs, I guess, from the, you know, they call it, Sadie calls it a failure. It sounds like both sides is just like middling. It's a failure only compared to the success of their other two games.
Well, Sadie feels the most that it's a failure because her side of the game is the game that people don't like. Sam has done all the work on Maple World, and that's the most popular part of the game. Yeah. And nobody likes the part that she worked on. So she feels that this is a personal failure.
Yes, she also drove them to make it.
Yeah. It was her idea. She and Sam couldn't really work together, so it's like she put him into designing Maple World, which would be like, I think in her mind was the lesser world and the lesser important part of the game. And it's become the best part of the game.
And again,
because Sam put so much of his experience and Alice's experience in the hospital, because that's the grounding story of this video game. And people respond to that much more than Sadie's.
And also just a kudos to Gabrielle Zevin. This is when they are first talking about their first game and what they want to make. Sadie is dedicated to making art. She is less concerned with the commercialization of the game, the fun quotient, right?
Yeah.
Not as much her focus. And it pulls through to this part that like she designed her game with a little bit more of an eye to that and less of an eye toward the end user having a fun time playing it and like having an emotional connection to it beyond the beauty of it. And it's well done because it brings us to this where like Sadie's going through it because she got what she wanted and it didn't live up to what she thought she was capable of.
Right.
And now for real, Sam's game is a little bit more popular. Like it is Sam's game that kind of popped in this one. They make a little Sam avatar who is Mayor Mazer in Maplewood, right?
Yeah.
In Maple World. So while this is going on, Dove calls Sadie and tells her that he is getting married to another student and that he is inviting her and Marx and Sam, the main characters. He's inviting the main characters to his wedding. So they drive up together, Sam, Sadie, and Marx. And on the drive up, Sam confronts them about dating. They go to Hearst Castle. They stop on the way. It's an overnight drive. They got to stop somewhere on the way. They go to Hearst Castle and Sam is very nasty to Sadie about Marx. He's very cruel about Marx. He calls him boring and he calls him an NPC, which is short for non-playable character. The people who are just wandering around in the background of games who are not the main characters of the game. He calls Marx that to his face. Like he's mean to Marx. He's mean to Sadie. He is not doing great with their relationship. So they overnight and in the morning when they wake up at the hotel to get back in the car, Sam has shaved his head overnight. And when Sadie, I don't know, looks askance at him about it, he's just like, it was just because I was hot. And I guess they go to the wedding. And in the scene, that's all we know. It's just like Sam comes out with a shaved head.
Right. We'll find out more about that later.
And he has been like a genuinely nasty person to both of them throughout this trip. So when they get back from this terrible trip to Dove's wedding, Sadie wants to make a theater game called Master of the Rooms. And Sam is just mean and shitty about it. Like, he is just not at all kind or thoughtful or considerate about the game. Marx takes Sadie's side and says that he thinks it's a good idea, which makes Sam even shittier and just be like, well, yeah, because you're screwing her. Like, he's awful about it. And Sadie tells Marx at this point why she hates Sam now about the Dove Dead Sea CD thing. And Marx tries to tell her that it's most likely that he put the game in and Sam never saw the note. And Sadie's not buying that. And she also tells him that she's mad that Sam took credit in her mind for Ichigo and that she's mad that she had to make Ichigo too. Marx tries to cover for Sam here, and I don't think Marx is lying. I think Marx is just sort of like, I would have gotten it. He has the hurt foot. I was always taking care of him. Like, I would have gotten that game and put it in. He would have never even seen that note. But again, when she confronts Sam about it, he just says, like, so what if I knew? Which, and when in the scene where it happens, it just ends with Sam finding the case with the game in it in a box. I don't know. Do you think it's supposed to be ambiguous whether or not Sam even saw this thing? I'm assuming that because Sam doesn't deny it and just says, so what if I knew, that he did see it. But again, because there's no interiority for certain things.
I think it's supposed to be ambiguous. I think it's something that we're supposed to be left guessing a little bit because the three of them are never going to know. So we don't get to know either.
Hmm. Well, Sam knows. I don't think Sam, nothing about his character makes me think that he would do that. But I don't
think he did. I do think it's meant to be ambiguous. Something I want to point out, when he goes over there to talk to her, she's in bed again. She's in bed. She's not going to work. That's part of the reason he goes over there, to check on her again, just like how he goes over there and sits with her the first time she's in bed.
Yes.
That we see her in bed, right? So it's like, she's in bed again. He goes over there partly because he knows she's upset, and he partly goes over there to talk to her about the game and to make her feel better about the fact that, like, everyone in the world hates Maple Worlds, that hates her version of Maple World and hates her part of it. So he goes over there to make her feel better again. And she's so shitty that he has this explosion of just like, what have I done to you? Why are you mad at me?
Do you think that's meant to mirror the book, that, like, it's called Both Sides? We as the reader see both sides of this. And do you think most people side with Sam? Just like they sided with Sam about both sides of the game?
I side with Sam a little bit in some of Sadie's stuff. Yeah.
Maybe side isn't the right, like, I don't know, but we...
Side isn't necessarily the right thing, but yeah, maybe.
Okay, so, all right. Ant and Simon go to San Francisco to get married because the mayor of San Francisco, I guess, declares that San Francisco is going to do same-sex marriages, even though it is federally illegal at this point.
Yes.
For, I guess, just reasons of solidarity, the main characters all go with them. While they are there, Sam and Sadie kind of make nice, going to get umbrellas for everybody when it starts raining. And they get along a little bit during this. They all come back, and very quickly, the marriages from San Francisco are deemed void and not real. The federal government's like, you can't do that. These are not recognized marriages. And it really bums, obviously, Aunt Simon out. They feel terrible about it. And this is what prompts Sam to decide that gay marriage, same-sex marriage, is going to be legal in Maple World. If you can't do it in this world, isn't the point of an immersive world that you can do whatever you want in and be whatever you want in and leave the regular world behind for a little while and experience, like, this thing that we do where we make these games? Isn't the point of that to be the person that you want to be? And why can't you have these things you can't have in my world? So he starts doing gay marriages. His character, Mayor Mazer, starts overseeing them and, like, marrying the avatars of people within the games.
Right.
Okay. So then Sam plays Master of the Reveals. He doesn't work on it. He doesn't do anything with it.
I want to point out, so after his experience with marriages, he would use Maple World to make even more political statements. He did not consider them to be political statements, but sensible governance and, not insignificantly, an excellent source of promotion. He banned user-created gun stores and the sale of weapons. He supported conservationism and the building of an Islamic cultural center by a group of Muslim Muslim Maple Townies. He arranged mass avatar protests about the war in Iraq and offshore oil drilling. He held town halls where he talked to residents about the issues facing Mapletown and the country. Every time he took a controversial stand, there'd be the same flurry of hate mail and cancellations of accounts, and then life would go on in Maple World and the world beyond it as well. And I just wanted to bring that up because I do feel like it helps. That helps to set the stage. That does help to set the stage for what is coming up.
Yeah, I think so. And this is also, we should point out, we have crossed the 2001 9/11 barrier at this point. We're on the other side.
Yeah.
Of
oh,
it.
Yeah.
They're launching Maple World like 2 weeks after 9/11 because they debate about it, like whether or not this is appropriate. And they had already picked the date. It wasn't
right. And they decide they're just going to go ahead with it because the world has to continue and because people deserve to have a bit of an escape and some place that feels wholesome and safe and where they can make things the way they want it to be and not this horrible stuff we have going on outside that's beyond our control.
It turns out that it is exactly what people wanted, was an escape from the horror of day-to-day life at that point, the existential dread and wretchedness that everybody was feeling in the post 9/11 world. And it actually makes the platform even more popular. And we should maybe point out, this is an online world that you can go to regularly and is not like a game that you play like from beginning to end, like Ichigo was.
No, this is a thing that you can consistently sign, and it's like The Sims or something. There's a game called like Second Life. That's what this is like.
Yes, that's a good example. Yes, it's like Second Life. Okay. Sam plays Master of the Reveals, the game that Sadie worked on by herself that he did not have any part in. And he tells Sadie that it's incredible, that he's upset that he didn't get to work on it, that it's true art, and that he wishes that he had made it with her and hadn't been, you know, an absolute turd about it, which he was. They go out to promote it together in a little bit of a mea culpa, right? Like they made friends a little bit more when they were in San Francisco for Ant and Simon's wedding. And he's come over and complimented her game and told her how brilliant that it is and how much he loves it. And they go to promote it together because he is lending her his celebrity. She recognizes that Sam is more famous than her because she has voluntarily not done this promotion before. And this is a little bit of just them making amends. They're going to go out together on the road and promote Sadie's game, and it's going to be a huge hit. Very soon into this, while they are on the road together, first Sadie realizes that she is pregnant. She's been throwing up every morning, and she gets a pregnancy test, and she's pregnant. And then Marx is killed by Republicans. That maybe wasn't a nice way to say that. Marx is killed.
I mean, I thought that was a hilarious way to say that because, I mean, call a spade, you know what I mean? Just anyways, go ahead.
While they're out, they get a phone call and it's a cliffhanger, but it's just, Sam's just like, Sadie, I'm so sorry, something like that. So we go into part 7 called the NPC. So we start the second person version of this, which is you, and the you is Marx. And Marx is a bird flying over a game and he swoops down and eats a strawberry. Going back to the Ichigo means strawberry thing anyway. So Charlotte and Adam are two new people who are at Unfair Games showing Marx their artwork and some of their early designs for a game that they want to make. This is while Sadie and Sam are on the road. All right, while this is going on, two masked and armed people, two guys come in and take the receptionist at Unfair Games hostage. And they are mad that Maple World has a gay marriage component in it at all, on the basis that, like, why should kids be exposed to the concept of gay marriage? That old chestnut. And because one of their wives played Maple World, met a lady in Maple World, got, I guess, married in Maple World to this lady and left him for this lady. And the other one is just had been his best friend forever and has come along with him. And they are downstairs demanding to see Sam Mazur. And they are just very flatly just like, look, we just need to see Sam and kill him. Marx gets everyone up to the roof, tells Simon or whichever, or Ant, one of them, to get everybody up to the roof. Marx goes down to reception because he doesn't want to leave the receptionist, who is a true NPC, they didn't even write his name down. He doesn't want to leave the receptionist down there with these two people to deal with this on his own and possibly get hurt because Marx is unflawed. No flaw whatsoever in Marx.
No flaws. He's a hero.
So he goes down and he's trying to talk these guys like down and trying to de-escalate the situation. they get him to take him up to the take them up to the offices of Unfair Games, which Marx does because he's hoping that Simon has gotten everybody up onto the roof out of the building or out of the office.
He wants them to see Sam's not there. He
wants them to see that nobody's there and that Sam is not there and that Sam isn't available and they should just go. That's what he's trying to get them to do. While they're up there going, ranting about all of their stuff, Simon comes back down from the roof, startling one of them who believes that he must be Sam or just he wants to shoot somebody. And he turns to shoot Simon or Ant, whichever one comes down the stairs. Marx jumps in front of the bullet and it hits him. And then the shooter
Well, Simon or Ant also get shot.
Oh, does he too? He does.
They get off more than one shot, and Marx is just the only one for whom it's fatal.
Okay. And then he turns the gun on himself and kills himself. So then Marx goes to the hospital where he has this very long coma vision. And that is the second person, like, you are swooping over a field, and he's kind of like visiting parts of the game. While he is having this sort of coma vision in the second person chapter, we get the background on the night from the hotel after Hearst Castle, where Marx knows that Sam is upset. He goes looking for him, and Sam is getting drunk in the bar badly because Sam doesn't really drink. He says more mean things to Marx, calls him an NPC again, confesses that he was in love with Sadie and he blew it. And Marx is always as kind to him and tries to make him feel better. Marx takes Sam back to his room. Sam goes to the bathroom and he's taking a long time and Marx goes to check on him and Sam has vomited all in his hair, tried to wash it, couldn't get the vomit out of his hair because he's so drunk. So he started trying to cut the vomit out of his hair and now he's cut half his hair off and he's drunk waving the scissors around or something. And Marx ultimately has to shave his head for him and take care of him again. And he ends this by giving him a kiss on the head. And then we know from the earlier part that the next morning when Sam comes out and Sadie looks at him, Marx never mentions this, never tells Sadie what happened, never goes through any of this with her and just keeps Sam's embarrassing like night to himself.
There's a really interesting quote about Sam and Sadie's relationship from this scene.
Hit me.
I wish I'd never met you. I wish we'd never been roommates. I wish I'd never introduced you to Sadie. Sadie doesn't belong to you. She does, Sam says. She's mine. And you knew that and you pursued her anyways. No, people don't belong to each other. Why not? Sam says, why not? Sam, are you going to marry her? Sam says. He says marry like he means murder. Not at the moment. What's so great about marriage? What's so great about sex? What's so great about making babies or playing house? Why can't you belong to the person with whom you share your work? Because there's life and there is work, and they aren't the same. They're the same for me. Maybe they're not the same for Sadie. Maybe they're not, Sam says quietly. I'm so screwed up. If I hadn't been such a screwed up coward, maybe I'd be the one going up to Sadie's hotel room. I know it's my fault. I know I had time. But I think that why can't you belong to the person with whom you share your work? Because there's life and there is work and they aren't the same. And he says, they're the same for me. And he says, maybe they're not the same for Sadie, but they've been the same for Sadie this entire book until she gets with Marx.
I would say that Sam is correct. I think you're right. I don't think Marx is right in that. He says, maybe they're not the same for Sadie, but I think they are.
I think they're the same for Sadie. I think that is a thing that they have in common.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think Sadie is very dedicated to her work. And I think you've pointed out, like, neither one of these people have a lot of outside friends. They are very driven by, like, the creative process and what they are making. And they're, like, we've had a lot of time with Sadie to see that her self-worth is very attached to it.
Oh, 100%. It's very attached to this game.
To the games and what she makes and the value of them and, like, how they're treated and how they're reviewed and everything. More so, I would say, than for Sam, even. Like the work for
Sam. The fact that they are successful for Sam in any way seems to be the thing that gives him value. Whereas like she needs it to be art. She needs it to be special. She needs everything to be the first Ichigo. And it's just not.
And I think for Sam, the work is Sadie.
Oh, interesting.
Like Sadie is the work because Sadie takes the development. She's hurt by the fact that she even needs Ulysses, not so much because it's Dove's, just that she isn't She's disappointed in herself that she doesn't have the time to make something really good. Right? She's pissed about that. She's pissed about Mark's producer credit. She is very dedicated to the craft and the work and the creative process. And I think Sam also likes those things. But I think for Sam, the work is Sadie being there.
Yeah.
Like working with Sadie is the work almost more than the games themselves, which maybe gives him a little bit of distance to allow him to understand that they need to be fun, that they need to be immersive, that they need to be commercial.
Yeah. She's close to it in a way that she can't really see that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought that was interesting of like why,
more,
you know,
about
why
what she can make than it is about what the end user experiences, where for Sam, because the work is Sadie, he is experiencing being with her. He has a little bit more of a vision into what the end user gets out of it. That's my theory. Anyhow,
yeah,
you can all use that on TikTok.
And something else he says, you've been here, but you're fundamentally unimportant. If you weren't here, it would be someone else. And that's when he calls him an NPC. And I
not
like,
true.
No, you and Sadie wouldn't be where you are without this person.
Absolutely not. You wouldn't be done with Ichigo yet.
You wouldn't even like, be done with Ichigo. You'd have never made Ichigo. You two would be lounging around doing nothing and Ichigo wouldn't exist. You would be an analyst at Harvard and she would be doing something else that you can do with an MIT degree. And none of this would have even happened without Marks.
It's interesting. I watched an interview with Gabrielle Zevin where the interviewer says, I think, like reading this is the part where we realize, and maybe we already knew it, that like this is as much Marks's book as it is Sam and Sadie's. And now I would agree with that. Gabrielle Zevin, when she said this, goes, I don't know about that. And she wrote the book and she's allowed to have her opinions on it. I agree with the interviewer, though, is I think this book is as much Marx's as Sadie's and Sam's. He is an NPC. Like, he does not have flaws. He does not have conflicts. Like, he's too perfect of a person.
Yeah.
And he is there just to get the main characters to the end point. Like, he only helps them. He does not hinder them at any point, except, I guess, unfortunately, by dying. But I think his point that if you didn't have him, you would just have main characters running around doing with no purpose or no goal is also accurate.
I'm looking at those quotes right now. The NPC can be a best friend, a talking computer, a child, a parent, a lover, a robot, a gruff platoon leader, or the villain. Sam, however, means this as an insult. In addition to calling you unimportant, he's saying you're boring and predictable, but the fact is there is no game without the NPC. And Marx responds to him when he says, you're unimportant, you're an NPC. There's just some bullshit. There's no game without the NPCs. There's just some bullshit hero wandering around with no one to talk to and nothing to do. And that is true. You need those other characters in there. They give you information and they do stuff and like they are a part of the story in the game.
Yeah, I think it's a fun take on the idea of the MacGuffin, which is like whatever the widget is that gets the story going. I think it's a fun take on that. I also think this part is really beautiful. I think this is a interesting emotional climax. I think it's interesting that it is an emotional climax that does not directly involve it involves the two main characters, but it's seen through this third person's eyes. And like we experience it with like, you know, because we loved Marx because he doesn't have any problems.
Right. He's like, a nice person. He's an unflawed character, which is incredibly unrealistic.
Yeah, no, super unrealistic.
Which is also an NPC, though. We don't need the NPCs to have, right?
They're no, they just run there.
We don't have a game and a story without them, but they don't need flaws or whatever. You know what I mean? Or whatever. It's like they're there to move the story forward, and so is Marx.
Despite the fact that it's a little bit strange that it shifts into second person and all of that, I think this is really effective, and I felt sad when Marx died.
Yeah, oh, for sure. No, it's a sad thing when he dies, but it does feel like it comes a little out of nowhere.
It does feel like it comes a little out of nowhere. Yes. Yes, it does. The hostage situation and this, it's not a book where you expect this kind of scene in the middle of it. The book at no point has felt like it has dealt with things as dangerous as what happens here.
Yes, 100%.
Okay, so we get little flashes in and out of this of Sadie and Sam visiting the hospital. We find out that Marx's mother's name is also Anna Lee.
Yeah, which, I mean, okay.
Yeah.
What the significance is with that, I just is not immediately apparent to me.
I could take stabs at what it might mean, but I would just be, hello, Rocco the cat. For those listening, Rebecca's cat Rocco just visited us on camera. I would just be taking guesses at thematic things that I know are well used from other books and just applying any kind of like random theme of what it might mean. I don't really know what it means in the context of this book.
No, I don't either. Maybe there's something that's the tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And something that we talked about is the, I suppose it makes sense to have a death in here because you don't have death in video games, or rather you do have death in video games, but it doesn't matter because you just start over again.
Yes, which they mention.
Which they mention, and it comes up a lot in the book. That is like a theme. That is a theme in the book that games do, like erase. That games are capable of immortality. They're capable of immortality. They're capable of erasing the consequences of your action, and you can just start over. And that's how this chapter ends. You were in the strawberry field. You were dead. A prompt comes up on the screen. Start game from the beginning, ? Yes, you think. Why not? If you play again, you might win. Suddenly, there you are, brand new, feathers restored, bones unbroken, sanguine with fresh blood. And it goes, there's a little bit more. And then it says, you're flying over the strawberry field, but you know it's a trap. This time you keep flying.
Ichigo was the trap. You're flying over the strawberry field and you know not to go down to it. And Ichigo means strawberry. And he knows this time you don't get involved with these two people.
That's a good point. Yes. That's nice. I really like how you dovetailed that, because I had really not made that strawberry connection.
Like, I've just taken a lot of flack from these two people. I mean, he does end up in a relationship with Sadie that seems both healthy, stable, and they really like each other. It ends with him being killed. So when I was reading the reviews, and when people talk about the emotionality of the book and how sad certain parts of it was, I get it here. Like, Marx was beloved.
Yeah, and this is a beautiful chapter.
Yeah.
I like the way she does it with this dream sequence, for lack of a better way of saying it, going back and forth so we understand what happened and why he's dead. It goes back to the first time he meets Sadie. This is a really well done part of the book. But now we get to part 8, and it's called Our Infinite Days, because this part of the book goes on for a really long time.
Yes. Sam goes back to open the offices. During this time when he's going, Sadie is not doing anything. Sadie is devastated. She is not coming to the offices. She's not really.
Sadie's in bed again. This one feels a little bit like, you're pregnant and your life partner, your business partner, someone you've been friends with since you were 20 years old just died. I'm giving her this one. I'm giving her getting in bed for this one.
When Sam had his foot amputated, she was very impatient with him not showing up at the office, though, I will say.
Sam had his foot amputated and was dealing with like incredible pain, and prosthetics are a lot of pain. Like in the beginning when you're using them, they're very painful. It's not like, okay, like now my stump's healed, I have my prosthetic and I can just do whatever I want.
Sam takes us through it, like how much pain he's in. She had little to no sympathy for that. Sam has, while he's like opening the offices, he flashes back on a memory of Sadie beating him in the chest in Marx's hospital room, screaming, they wanted you. They wanted you. Because Sadie does not, she's upset. She also doesn't really like Sam.
She's upset, but she also hates Sam.
Yeah. So Sam opens the offices. Sadie won't come in. Counterpart High is up to part 4 or something like this. They were going to do one for each year of high school. They have a launch party. During the launch party, Sam finds the game that the couple, Charlotte and Adam, who came to the office the day Marx is killed, who were there when it happened, who were in the office that day, he finds the folder that Marx had left for him, the Our Infinite Days portfolio, and calls them in and they make that game. Okay. Then Sam, while this is going on, he's learning all the things that Marx did for them. He is really going through a thing of recognizing like all the effort his NPC friend put into making them successful, and learning how to run the business and run the company and just really keeping things going, bringing people back. And then he gets the idea for a game called Pioneers, because he misses Sadie. And Pioneers is an MMORPG kind of based on Oregon Trail and like the world of Oregon Trail. And he starts imagining conversations between him and Sadie about how to build it, which is what leads him to be able to create it. And then this is, Rebecca, I cannot emphasize enough what a garbage section I think the Pioneers section is. I think it's cheap writing. I think it's lacking in any emotional depth. I think it's a cop-out. I think it's lowered even more by the fact that we had the NPC chapter that Marx took us through in the second person that involved being in a video game for part of it. I didn't even summarize it for the plot, but essentially just, we have to just read 20 pages of an MMORPG where these two characters meet and they're clearly Sadie and Sam, and it's so boring. I don't summarize it. And it also, reading it, I'm just sort of like, this is the games they make? They've been making terrible games. It's what they're making.
I did actually read a Reddit that was about how, like, if you're a gamer, you probably don't like this book. And that the people who like the book the most are the ones who start with, well, I don't play video games and I'm not a gamer, but I loved this book. There was a whole Reddit about it that was a really enjoyable read.
I gotta say, when I was reading commentary and stuff online and reviews and things of this book, like both personal and professional, so many people feel the need to be like, well, I don't play video games, so I didn't know if I would like this. Which surprised me, because I can't imagine any other book being about a thing where you would say that. Imagine if you picked up a Tom Clancy book and you're like, oh, well, I've never worked for the CIA. I don't know if I'll enjoy this. Oh, my brilliant friend, I've never been a young girl in Italy. I don't know if this is really for me. Like, what the fuck does that have to do with it? You don't play video games. You never do any of the things that are in books. That's why you read the book. Can you imagine picking up a John Grisham novel and being like,
yeah, I read stuff about things I have no idea about all the time. I think that sometimes people say that because it's like, I don't want to be associated as some gamer nerd because I say that I like this book. It's like some qualifier where people don't want to be like associated or something, which I mean, I don't support because like I said, I don't know. If this is a way that you enjoy passing the time, I don't know. It seems harmless. And if you enjoy it, go for it. So I don't look at it that way. But yeah, it's like that's a little bit the impression I get.
Oh, I was never in World War II. I can't read The Nightingale.
Can't read The Nightingale.
I didn't know if I would like this, not being, you know, not having a sister or being part of the French resistance in World War II. Yet. Anyway, I hate the Pioneers part.
I hate the Pioneers part. I think it's a so cheap bad. Way of, yeah. I think it's a cheap way of being like, oh, look, what if they had been together? It's a cheap way of putting Sam and Sadie together romantically. Because it's not going to happen.
It's also tedious. It's like just, it's not a fun read.
It's tedious. And then it doesn't make her like get over it and be his friend. Then she's just mad at Sam again for tricking her.
Yeah.
For making this whole game that makes her money because that makes her even richer than she already was because she's still a part owner in this, an unfair game. So he's put all this time and effort into making this game in order to connect with her because he's her friend and he cares about her and he knows that she's sad and he understands why she's sad. So this is where we have a little bit of like character arc, because something that I have a note that I made about Sam is
he is far more understanding about her not like being during any of
it. He starts channeling Marx. What would Marx do? And he develops like empathy. Like he puts himself in her shoes. I've lost my business partner and a very good friend. She's lost her business partner, a friend, her husband, and the father of her child, life partner and the father of her child. This is harder for her. This is harder for her than it is for me. And I'm struggling with it. This is also the first time something like this has happened to her. He's lost somebody. He knows how to grieve. He's familiar with like grief and stuff.
He's lost somebody and he's lost pieces of himself.
And yes, this man has been through a lot. So he's very understanding of her. He goes through this whole thing. He makes this game that, again, like he's continuing their company forward. He puts all this effort into making a game for her to make her feel better, to reconnect as friends. And she blows it off and uses it as an excuse to be mad at him again. And I think she brings it up with Dove. They have lunch or something and she like tells him what's going on and she's mad about it. And even Dove's kind of like, yeah, I'm not with you on this.
Yes. So when this interminable part finally ends, we pick up at Sadie having lunch with Dove and Dove is just saying, some part of you must have known it was him. And she's like, yeah, he tricked me again. Oh, Sam, such a manipulator. And Dove's just sort of like, you still hang out with me. And Dove calls it. He's like, I was so much worse to you.
I was a terrible boyfriend to you.
Anything Sam has ever done. Why are you treating him this way? It's a super romantic gesture to build an entire world for you. And she's like, no, nope.
No.
Nope. And but she is suffering. She has lost her business partner, her dear friend, her lover, the father of her child. This is the first major loss that Sadie has experienced that we've been through in this book. Because even when her grandmother dies, it's a single line in the Pioneer section. Sadie takes Dove's teaching position back at MIT because she carries on the relationship with Dove that she would rather slit her wrists than even entertain having with Sadie.
Yeah, which, and I'm gonna say it right here and now. Here's my hot take. You know who's a decent friend throughout this book is Sam. Do you know who's not a good friend throughout this book is Sadie. He is more consistently a good friend to her throughout this book.
And he certainly acts poorly at many points in this book, but he is.
Yeah, she does.
I think he is a better friend to her than she is to him. But Sadie takes Dove's teaching position. She loves it. She loves teaching, doing all the things that, like, she had critiqued Dove for doing when he was a teacher. She learns everybody's names. She really likes engaging with the kids and, like, finding out what they're developing and talking about these things. Sam's grandfather, Dong Hyun, dies. And, you know, I mean, just as far as Sam's concerned, line him up. How much loss can a guy go through before he's 40? Are they 40 at this point? They might be 40 at this point.
Maybe just. They're in their 30s somewhere, yeah.
Either way, Sam experiences another loss. Sadie manages to scrape up the grace to actually go out to the funeral where they connect again. Dong has left her something in his will, and it's the Donkey Kong game from the pizza parlor. And in what just feels like, I don't know, kicking sand in his eyes, it's very sweet that Dong has thought of Sadie, the girl who brought his precious grandson out of his, like, nonverbal phase, brought him out of the possible abyss that he could have lost him in, on top of already losing his daughter. And Dong and Bong, it seems like, have both kept an affection for this child who, like, saved them from losing somebody else, right? In a way.
Yeah.
And that she leaves him something. And she takes it and she is grateful for it. And she moves the Donkey Kong game all the way across the US of A from sunny California to grimy gray Massachusetts. But Sam's high score is lost when it happens. And it just feels like one more piece of Sam being erased so that she can have a Donkey Kong machine in her office.
But it does say that it's been up there so long that it's burned into the memory of the machine. So it is still in there a little bit. Like how he is still burned into her a little bit, as much as she's trying to ditch him.
It's just,
I think Dong leaves it for her to, I think he leaves it so that there's a door. So I think he leaves it so that there's an open door for which they have to communicate again.
I know. And I find that incredibly heartbreaking and sweet. Sam takes a lot of hits in this book. And I'm like, really feel for the little guy by the end of it.
Yeah, I did. I feel for him by the end of it.
But it does. It opens a door, and the book ends with, I can't remember why they see each other again. They take a meeting together for Unfair Games.
Oh, they take a meeting.
They go somewhere together for it. Her flight is the first one out. They're in the airport together.
Yeah.
Someone wants to make Ichigo 3, and they go out to talk to them about it. They're entertaining the idea. And they have a conversation in the airport, and he asks her why they never got together. And she's like, oh, what we have is, you know, creative partners is even better than being lovers. Which I don't, again, like as a, it just feels like this whole novel has just been like this lady kind of friend zone in this guy. The way that's phrased, I don't love that part. But she slips him a jump drive with another game on it. And she's just like, a little something I've been working on. I do like that part, that we get the sort of like the same thing that happened in the beginning. Like, we're going to go round two, right? Like, they're going to make another banger. And she gets on the plane and he looks down at the drive, which is named for her daughter, I think.
No, it's Ludo Sextus. That's the kid they have in Pioneers, right?
Oh,
they have a kid in Pioneers. They get married and they have a kid in Pioneers. His name is Ludo Sextus. I don't remember what the reference for it is for that. And that's the name of this game.
You're correct. The game is called Ludo Sextus, and she hands him the jump drive. And she's like, a little something I've been working on. And he looks down and he's like, her handwriting, he'd recognize it anywhere. And that's where it ends.
And that's where it starts. And I do like that. I do like when things come full circle like that.
When it follows the video game thing, like you die you get another life. You can start over.
Yeah.
And that's where we're leaving at them, like getting another life professionally together. And their child, their baby, I guess that's why she has that line where she's like, no, what we make is like better than being in a relationship. And then she hands him their literal child, right? Ludosexus, their child from Pioneers.
Yeah.
And their child in the sense that it is a game that they will end up working on together and creating and making another thing together.
She's coming back.
Yes. And that's the end of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, which I want to be very clear. Two major critiques are just the big emotional like climax from that sort of first part feels like it just happens and then a wall goes up. And then the Pioneers part is just abysmal. I can't say enough bad things about it.
For me, my criticism is that she puts these hot topics in that do feel like a little anachronistic because they do feel like the things we are talking about so much now. And I understand that we're talking about them now because they've always existed, that these have always been problems. So I'm not being so like obtuse as to be like, but these are issues that we talk about now. They didn't exist in the 90s.
But this is a novel about two creative partners having their ups and downs. And what does it mean to make something with somebody? And what does it mean to have a relationship that centers around that instead of around physical love? And what does it mean to do all these things? And just that doesn't feel like a story that, like, by the way, a little defense of gay marriage here in the middle just doesn't feel like it, but goes that, in this particular.
That leads to this murder. That leads to this.
Leads to a
murder.
That
leads to murder and leads to this coming in. Yeah, like that part just that felt a little bit like, what? For me? When we talk about the sexism at MIT and like with the games, that's real. That fits. The stuff with Sam's disability, that's real. That fits in this. I do think his disability stuff is handled well. Like how much we are in his head and stuff for that, I think is written well to put you in someone else's like experience with that. I did think that stuff was good. Something that I wanted to point out, man, this girl loves vocab. She loves using yeah. big words. And I wrote some of them down. Deictic. I forgot what that means. I had to look it up. I'd never heard of it. Verisimilitude comes up many times. That has to do with truth. I did know that one. Luddic.
I like verisimilitude.
I like verisimilitude a lot. Luddic.
Luddic, I knew. And
Luddic, I knew. Luddic, I knew, although I did have to revisit the definition.
It's used a lot in talking about like game design and gameplay. The idea of something being playable, of having narrative in that sense that you can use it as a game. I don't think I knew. I had to look that one up.
I'll look it up.
Again,
I'm
not saying it right. I had to look that one up.
I could be saying it wrong. Deictic. To me, it seems like deity, so I would pronounce it like deictic. D-E-I-C-T-I-C. Relating to or denoting a word or expression whose meaning is dependent on the context in which it is used, such as here, you, me, that one there, or next Tuesday.
Oh, fire. Oh.
Fire.
Like you could be fired. You could start a fire.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
You could fire a gun. You could fire software updates.
I like that too. I love reading things that I have to look up what works to me because I don't know what they mean. Oh, verdigris.
What does that one mean? Did you look it up?
I did. It's a blue-green patina that forms on copper, brass, and bronze due to oxidation. And it's also a pigment made from copper acetates. The Statue of Liberty is verdigris.
Oh, look at that. I like that.
And portmanteau.
I love portmanteaus. I like making them. I like saying it. People complained about that. The people who didn't like this book, and I think people often probably cite this in reviews of books they don't enjoy. It was just like, she just thinks she's clever because she's using all these words I don't know. And I dislike that, because look them up. You're holding the fucking internet in your pocket all the time. Look it up. If you're reading it on a device, it'll probably look it up for you.
It'll probably look it up for you. You could just tap it and it'll tell you.
Lazy, ignorant, incurious SOB.
I agree.
Just learn a word. Learn a new word.
That's how you learn things and learn new words. Just look it up. I love it. I love reading a book that's got a bunch of words I don't know in it, and then I look them up. That's how I learned the word bucolic, and I love that word.
Maybe if it was the 60s and like you had to keep a dictionary next to you to do it, and that's a little bit inconvenient, but even that is a little bit inconvenient. Grow up.
Yeah.
right now you've just got a phone in your pocket. You don't even have to type the word, you lazy bastard. You can say it into this thing and it'll tell you what it means. It's never been easier to learn a word. There's no point in the history of humankind has there been less of a barrier between a word on a page and your brain full of stupid holes and bong resin than there is right now. Just look it up. The world is
yeah, that, yeah, I like reading that. I like literary books for that reason. I do think it's clever.
I also think she writes well enough to support it. It's not like reading, I don't know, a middle grade novel and they're just cramming thesaurus words in there. The prose and the style and the tone of the book support the...
Support. This is a literary book. It has literary ideas and we can have words in here that we have to look up. I had to look some of them up.
It supports the language that she's using and I am here for it. So I liked this. I enjoy this book. I'm glad people like it and I hope it continues to be successful. And I hope that more books like it become this big. I hope they put money into marketing more books that are, you know, for adults. They're just a grown up person.
It is a good book. It is a good literary adult book. We have clearly found a lot to talk about with it. After the audio reading, I was a little bit like, huh, so people really love this, huh? And then when I actually read it, it was like, oh, okay, this is a better book than I remembered. But I did still finish it with a little bit of a feeling of, does this need to be on every single bookstore table? But it is a good book. I think it's well written.
I think its popularity is also directly tied to the marketing campaign that went into it. I think they put Zevin on like an 18-month book tour for this thing. She was on the road. She was doing panels. She was doing interviews. She was on podcasts. She was on YouTube shows. She was doing magazine profiles. They had her out there promoing this thing. They put a lot of advertising dollars behind it. They got it front and center. And I like seeing books get, I don't know, they do it for the Avengers and those movies are all middling. They're fine. But I'm glad they put like this kind of energy behind a novel. I like seeing that.
Is this something that's a little smarter?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yes, I would agree.
Yeah. This is something that has has a little more substance.
Does it pass the moral test?
It does, because she talks to her grandmother, she talks to Zoe, she talks to Alice. And Sadie, for what it's worth, is not super focused on her romantic relationships.
No, she's not.
But this does pass the Bechdel. And we have a strong female character in Sadie. She's a flawed character, as most of us are flawed human beings. And we don't love her all of the time. But she does a lot of redeeming things. And I think she's a pretty solid female character.
I think so. I don't agree with all of her choices. And that's what makes her fun to read about. And what makes the book interesting is that Sadie is not... I hate to use like the internet parlance, but she's not a Mary Sue. She is a fully formed character with like flaws and benefits, or I'm sorry, flaws and like positive aspects. I think she's well drawn. Did you do the casting call?
Of course I did the casting call. I'm pretty pleased with my casting call, actually.
I'm also pleased with mine. I did our three mains and then Dove. I did four people.
I didn't do Dove. I don't know. I forgot about him for some reason. I forgot. I did our three main and then the grandparents.
Okay. So for Sam, Sam is half Korean and half Jewish. Mm-hmm. I do not just have in my bank of actors a half Korean, half Jewish actor. Don't have one. There's one out there. I apologize to whoever it is, but I don't have the call for that. So I've cast two people who I both think would do the character himself justice. The first is Elijah Wood, who is not Jewish, but I think Elijah Wood has like the stature and plays like a certain vulnerability well that I think would be good. And the other is Steven Yeun from, you might know him from The Walking Dead. You might know him more recently from Nope. He's in like 100 things. Actually, he's in a lot of stuff currently.
He's in a lot of stuff. Yeah. I had to look him up to have his face like in my brain, but yeah, I've seen this guy.
I think he might have been nominated for an Oscar or something recently, actually. But anyway, Steven Yeun and Elijah Wood. I think we probably want to lean towards Steven Yeun because I think based on the art, like, I don't know if there's that one article where Sam goes ham on that interviewer who accuses them of appropriation for making Ichigo kind of Japanese themed.
Oh, I'm really glad you brought that up because I was remiss that we had missed talking about that, because I do think that is an issue that she covered. I think that is an issue that is something that is talked about today a lot, and I think that she addressed it really well in this book.
I also think it's appropriate to the era. This is a very Gen X book. That is the response of that generation, is just sort of like, you can't, like, there's appropriation in things that are inappropriate, but or in a way that is inappropriate and insensitive, but you can't just have Japanese people only can ever use Japanese references. And the world doesn't work that way. It's limiting. It crushes art. And I don't know, Sam goes ham on it. And he's like, but I guess if it was Korean, you wouldn't have this fucking problem.
Yeah. And I love that, because it is true. And do I agree that, I don't know, do I agree that girls at music festivals shouldn't be dressed as Native American Indians running around doing ecstasy? Yeah, I think that's an appropriate, like, cultural appropriation.
That
but like
insensitive.
But if we have zero appreciation for other cultures and our art and our references and our these things, like, the hell is that? That also doesn't track. Like, that, then there's no empathy or caring for people that aren't exactly like you.
Well, yeah. And also, I mean,
you know what I mean? Like,
Gabrielle Zevin wouldn't be, I don't know, Dove couldn't be in this book.
Yeah. Can't write about Dove. He's Israeli.
Yeah. I mean, a lot, maybe he's not the, you know what? Mark couldn't be in this book.
Mark couldn't be in this book.
Yeah. Better.
Mark is 100% Asian. I think both of his parents are.
He's Japanese.
I think his mom's like Japanese American and his dad's Japanese or something along those lines. But
I think he's from Japan, though. Didn't he go to high school there? When they go back,
he went to high school there. But I think his mom is like American. I think his mom's American.
I think
she doesn't speak the language and stuff well. She's very isolated when they're in Japan. I don't remember what the deal is now. I think his mom might be like white and Asian.
But isn't he from? Like, he himself was born in Japan, right?
I don't remember if he was born there, but he did grow up there.
Oh, well, okay. But anyway, yes.
But yes, exactly. If I was Korean, we wouldn't be having this conversation. It's because he's Japanese. And like,
at the end, when they're having one of their final conversations, and Sadie is telling Sam about teaching her class, and she makes a comment where she's like, these kids, just their entire story is their trauma. They don't get over anything. They never move on. They never move past a single thing. This book takes pains to call out the cultural temperament of the people of this age versus different generations. Who do you have for Sam?
Okay, before I say my casting for Sam, I want to read a quote about what Sam looks like. Because it comes up.
I think Steven Yeun is, by the way, Korean.
Oh. It comes up a couple times what Sam looks like. It's referenced what he looks like in the beginning, like when Marks meets him, and I'm going to read that. And then it's referenced that he looks like Ichigo. Yeah. And I think there's talk in the book that Sadie kind of has Sam in mind when she's making Ichigo. He does look like Sam. He is a little bit like Sam.
I mean,
he walks like Sam.
People point it out.
Looks like Sam.
Say, no, it's not Sam.
But it's definitely Sam, and she's the one who created it.
Yeah.
But anyways, when Sam finally returned to the room, Marks couldn't help but smile. With his sweet, roundish face, light-colored eyes, and mix of white and Asian features, Sam looked almost exactly like an anime character. Astro Boy, or one of the many wisecracking little brothers of manga. As for his personal style, Sam looked like Oliver Twist during the Artful Dodger years, if Oliver Twist had been from Southern California and a low-level pot dealer instead of a pickpocket. I love that line. That was one of my favorite. I laughed out loud when I read that. It was one of my favorite. That was one of my favorite parts.
She's got some hits in here.
Sam had dark curly hair that he wore parted in the middle and bluntly cut just above his shoulders. He wore cheap John Lennon style wire rimmed glasses and one of those rough hemp striped parkas that are sold in Mexico. I think kids now call those drug rugs. I learned that recently. His blue jeans were holy and faded to almost white, and he paired his Tevas sandals with thick white athletic socks. And that's our introduction to Sam. And something that's discussed about Sam is that Sam has very round features. Like, his head is very round and his face is very round and his eyes are round, but he still looks Korean. So with that in mind,
all the circles that would make him up.
All the circles. Yes. Thank you. All of the circles that, and they're as referred to a few times throughout the book. So my casting is Darren Barnett. And so for my Netflix lovers who love Mindy Kaling, it is Paxton Hall Yoshida. From the very excellent show Never Have I Ever. And if you have not seen it, you're sleeping on it. And I highly recommend that you go watch it on Netflix. And if you look up Darren Barnett as Paxton Hall Yoshida, he's round.
Okay.
I recently learned this term from somebody who is white and Asian, and he referred to himself as Wasian, which I really loved. And I thought was a super cute little moniker. And I really loved that. And I laughed so hard when he told me that. I was like, you just refer to yourself as Wasian? He's like, yeah, Wasian. You've never heard that? Anyways, Darren Barnett, I believe, is mixed race. And so is Sam. And so I thought he'd be a good cast. But really a lot of why I cast him is he has those like roundish features. And his hair is like kind of curly. So like if you look at a picture of him, he is a little bit like he's got that curly hair that I think could read as Jewish.
I'm looking at him. He'd be a good pick.
Yeah. So that's my cast for Sam. For Sadie, Emma Watson. Emma Watson.
Is that Hermione?
That's Hermione. Because Emma Watson.
Okay.
Emma Watson is beautiful. And so I feel like she can pull off this girl that these two men are in love with because she's pretty, but she does smart and serious well. And Sadie is not like a funny, she's not a funny outgoing character. She is smart and serious.
No, she's not. There's a description of her in there that I thought was well done where she was thinking about herself and she's like, I don't like going to parties. I don't like this. I like hotel rooms and I like staying in and getting ready for bed and taking a bath. And she's not humorous. She's not a party girl. She is not wild. She describes herself as a sort of like a calm, steady, serious person.
Yeah.
She knows that about.
And Emma Watson does that well. I think she's a really beautiful girl without being the main thing about her.
I did Melanie Lynskey.
I love Melanie Lynskey. Oh, that's a solid cast. Too. Yeah.
And
I like.
I think also because I've been looking at Melanie Lynskey since she was, I think, like 16, which is a little bit older than this book starts. But like Melanie Lynskey has been in movies that I have been watching since she was a kid, when she got picked out of a high school to star opposite Titanic. Her name just
Kate Winslet.
Flew. Thank Kate you. Winslet. Yes. In that Peter Jackson movie that I think is still considered a bombshell entree for a director, but I've looked at her forever. So I've actually seen her over the course of 30 some years, however long this book takes. This is like a 30 year stretch in this book. And something about one of the ways they described her, she had like a California goth look.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I could see that. Yeah.
And Melanie Lynskey's got that dark hair. And I was like, that's, you're the girl who like, she's got that sort of enigmatic look that I think would work for this as well. And I also just like Melanie Lynskey, put her in everything. Okay. I want to talk about Marks. I know that there are better choices age-wise. I know that this is Stephen Hawking's casting call and the age does not really matter. But I know that like Henry Golding, who you might have seen in The Gentlemen, would be fantastic for this. I know Manny Jacinto from The Good Place could be a great Marks. I know that Jimmy Yang from Silicon Valley and Interior Chinatown is someone who I am really enjoying as a young actor who would be a good part for this. But I have to give it to my man, Harold, from Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle.
That is also who I cast as Marks. There was zero other choice. He's good looking. He's good looking. He's funny. He comes across as he could do this like flawless. Everybody likes me. Good. I'm good looking, and I'm really. I also hit John Cho.
I realize the man is 50 something years old at this point. And it's in no way an appropriate age. And again,
doesn't matter.
Matter for this. I also know that like
we do not take space or time into account when we do these casting calls. I also cast John Cho, and I also cast him based on as Harold.
Yeah, I've loved the Harold,
from the Harold years
franchise for so long. I was like, it's got to be my guy, John Cho. That's his
Harold and Kumar is a real top 10 movie for me, and I'm not embarrassed. I'm saying it out loud on this podcast. Come
whole franchise.
Me.
I'll watch any of them anytime. Love it. Who'd you do for Dove?
I didn't do Dove, and now I feel really sad about that. I don't know why I didn't. I don't know why I didn't cast him.
Sacha Baron Cohen.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, solid.
I think he's an annoying douchebag in real life. Probably, I've never met.
He's definitely probably an annoying douchebag in real life, and I think he would do this annoying douchebag real well.
Yeah, I've never met him. He doesn't talk to me. He doesn't know who I am, but and he's never done anything wrong to me either. I just suspect that he probably sucks a little bit in real life. And I think
that he sucks a little bit in real life. I don't know why. I just also have that notion.
I think he's like Dove in real life. That's what I think.
I think that you're probably right.
I don't think it's a stretch.
I cast the grandparents.
Okay, who you got for Bong and Dong?
So for Dong, Ralph On, who is, where did I get him from? He plays an older Asian man in a lot of things. And the thing that I've seen him in, which is he's a New Girl.
That's what I most recently recognize him from.
He's a New Girl, and he's this old Asian man that Nick meets in the park and makes friends with, even though he doesn't really say anything. But he has this like gentle grandfatherly vibe about him that I feel like is Dong.
I've been watching Ralph On for a long time.
Yeah, he's in all sorts of things. The New Girl was just the most recent reference.
He's a fairly prolific character actor. All right. Who do you have for Bong?
For Bong, Amy Hill. What I know her from most recently is a show called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend that does currently stream on Netflix that I love. I think is a really great show. She plays Josh Chan's mom. Josh Chan's a big, important character in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. She plays his mom, Lourdes. And I'm casting her at her age now, not the age she was in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, where she would be more of like an appropriate grandmother age.
Amy Hill has been in the game for a minute.
She's been around forever. I see her in things all of the time. Her and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend was what inspired me to cast her.
Off the top of my head, I remember her from Margaret Cho had a television show for a little while, I think. And she was in that as her, I can't remember if she was her grandmother or her mother, but she was in Margaret Cho's show. She's in 50 First Dates.
Oh, she is. Yeah, she's in 50 First Dates.
I'm going to look her up. Hang on. Let's see. She's got like hundreds of listings.
She's in so many things. After I cast her in this, I saw her in something like the next day. I don't still remember what it was.
She's been in every sitcom that's ever been on at some point or another. She's been on King of the Hill. She's been on Frasier. She has been on Boston Common. She's been on Seinfeld. All the way going back to Growing Pains. Night Court, Perfect Strangers. Yeah, she got around.
I have one more. I also cast Frida. I also cast her from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and from the new show Nobody Wants This that's on Netflix that people really like. So I cast Frida Tova Felsha.
Okay.
She's quintessentially Jewish and she typically plays Jewish moms or Jewish grandmothers. But the reason I picked her, she's very pretty. I think she's very attractive. And Frida is described as like, Frida does like very well for herself in real estate. Frida is a fancy Beverly Hills Jewish grandma. You know what I mean? Frida is not Yetta from The Nanny. Frida is like a Hollywood movie looking grandma.
Tova also has a buttload of credits.
She's in all sorts of things. Like I said, most recently I've seen her in Nobody Wants This, where she is Seth Cohen's mom. Not Seth Cohen. What's his name? Adam Brody's mom.
Was he Seth on The OC?
He's Seth Cohen in The OC. Yeah. He's Dave Rogowski on Gilmore Girls. He's the main character, the main male character, and Nobody Wants This. And Tova Felsha is his mother.
All right. Who do you have for You Know Who You Look Like? What book?
I actually have several for this.
Okay. What do you got?
So one of them was Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine. And that was just because of the vocabulary.
Okay.
Nothing else, but it was just like the vocabulary made me think of Eleanor Oliphant. My brilliant friend, because of the like volatile nature of Sam and Sadie's relationship, like this love, this hate, this jealousy.
Okay.
They do want good things for each other. They do support each other's like ambitions and ideas, but they also don't. Like those girls go back and forth a lot. There's a book called The Solitude of Prime Numbers by Paolo Giordano.
Oh God. I think you're right. That book was just emotionally devastating.
It's emotionally devastating. And it because one or both of the characters it's a boy girl friendship that like, isn't quite about romance. It's more about them sharing devastation.
Yes.
And it spans years and it's bleak as hell. And like the main female character has a disability. I can't remember if the male does, but it's also like from an accident that like affects as a child that affects her for the rest of her life.
Father causes it.
And the father caused it. And it is an emotionally devastating book for sure. But
mom sent me that and I called her afterwards and I was like,
I read it and I liked it. It emotionally devastated me. And it was like, this book is so good. I still think about it. I still have it.
I think about it with horror. I do think about it a lot. It was so, so sad.
My number one, though, my number one, you know who you look like, is Conversations with Friends.
Okay.
Because the main characters are a little hard to like.
Okay.
It's also just like quite a literary novel.
Yeah.
It's a lot about creatives and different kinds of media and art and their relationships to the art they're creating and their relationships to each other, like within that. They're all writers or one of, you know, writers, actors. They're all creatives and like artists in some capacity. And then just complex relationship dynamics.
Okay. I think those are all good. I only had one and I feel unprepared because you had three. But mine was
I had four.
And I can't count. Utopia Avenue by David Mitchell. I don't know if you
read it. Oh, that's a great one. Yes, I read it. I gave it to you, I think.
That is probably where I got it.
Yeah, I gave that to you. That's an excellent book. Oh, I love that book.
It is about several people coming together to form a band. And structurally, it has a little bit of a similar vibe to this, where it's people coming together for a creative endeavor. And then we flash back to parts in their past and get their stories and their development and like who they are as characters. And also,
and how that inspires what they're creating.
How it inspires what they're creating, how it bleeds through into the songs that they write. And you can track the character development into the songs that they put out and the way they treat one another and kind of their own inter-band conflicts and so forth. And also an unexpected out of left field shooting drives the high point of the highlight conflict point. I don't know, the sort of like emotional peak of the novel. And that shooting, I would say, as much as I enjoyed that book, also just feels like, okay.
That was how I felt when I read it too. It's shocking. And it feels, I don't say it feels out of place, but it was also just, that's really not where I thought this whole thing was going.
You know what we're going to have to do on this show? We're going to have to do Cloud Atlas.
Did we?
You didn't like that?
I mean, I read it.
Oh, well, I mean, it's our show. We don't have to do it.
I read it and I didn't dislike it, but the thought of having to read it again makes me be like, but I read it. I don't know. It's like if I had gotten all the way through War and Peace and then you were like, you know what we should do is War and Peace for this show. And I'd be like, man, I was just trying to check that one off the list. But maybe I'll like it on a set. I have to say, when we go back and we read things to do
down the road,
when we go back and I reread things for a podcast, I do reread it with a different perspective and eye and stuff. So maybe.
But I get it. There are some times where I go back, we're like, when we're rereading things we've already read, where I'm like, this doesn't feel like progress in my reading goals.
It's a little bit bad. And it honestly was a bit of a slog for me to get through. It was one of those ones that was just like, I wanted to read it because people had told me it was like amazing. And it just felt like this book of the century that like I needed to read. And then as I was reading, it was just like, I hate all of you. And I wish I was done with this book.
Yeah. A modern book that's considered a popular classic. Let's skip it. We can kick that can down the road. I just realized that's one we should probably put on.
We should probably do it.
I don't have a lot of quotes. I have two. And the only reason I had three, but I had to use one at the top of the episode.
I have one.
Well, I'm going to go first then. You
go first. Yeah.
Three of them. So my first one is, I don't remember even who said this. The quote is, but it is worth noting that to be good at something is not quite the same as loving it. And I think this is said when Sam is realizing that he doesn't want to pursue math. He's good at it, but he realizes he doesn't want to do it as his major. And it's not certainly pithy or anything, but like Dove's quote about once you have children, you won't ever be able to be concerned about a friend in quite the same way. I just think this is incredibly accurate. I think it's also something that is very appropriate for young people in college having to come to Jesus moment where like, oh, I am good at math. Do I actually want to be a fucking accountant for the rest of my life? All right, give me one.
So when Sam is going to ask Sadie to make a game with him, he like wants to make it special. Like he does it like a proposal, right? It is a proposal, but not a wedding proposal. But he makes it like a wedding proposal. He wants to take her to this really special place with the glass, this place at Harvard that has these glass flowers. The Ware collection of Bloschka glass models of plants consists of around 4,000 painstakingly accurate fire-blown glass and hand-painted specimens. A German father and son team had made them around the turn of the 19th century as a commission from the university. They were the answer to a problem. How do you preserve the impossible to preserve? Or in other words, how do you stop time and death? Could there have been a more propitious propitious also,
there you go.
There's one of our vocab words. Could there have been a more propitious place to begin the company that would become Unfair Games? What, after all, is a video game's subtextual preoccupation, if not the erasure of mortality? I just think that sums up a lot of what's going on in the book. It sums up the title of the book, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, is that we get all these chances, like with video games. And
that's also got a little bit of a Gabrielle Zevin flexing those fingers and be like, I'm going to rip one right now. I'm going to put together a hell of a sentence. Stand back.
Yeah.
Stand back. Propitity and erasure are about to be used.
Exactly. Yeah. I just thought that it just sums up a lot of what this book is about. And I did find one more quote that I had marked that I'll read, but you go next.
My next one is, it isn't a sadness, but a joy that we don't do the same things for the length of our lives. I think for the same reasons that I liked the other one, I think that is a true thing about life. Like, it is not the pithiest sentence, but I think it is a true observation.
My last one is, throughout his life, Sam had hated being told to, quote unquote, fight, as if sickness were a character failing. Illness could not be defeated, no matter how hard you fought, and pain, once it had you in its grasp, was transformational. So the last part of that about pain being transformational reminded me of Demon Copperhead.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But the first part of that, throughout his life, Sam had hated being told to fight as if sickness were a character failing. I agree with that. And especially in my job, I see that. Like when people have cancer and these things, like, well, they just have to fight. You just have to keep fighting. You just have to keep. And it's like, don't assign that to people. That's a shitty thing to assign to somebody that's going through this. I think the people think it's caring because it's like, oh, I want you to get well and I want you to be better because I love you and I care about you. And I know that's where it comes from. That's a shitty thing to say to somebody. People don't always recover from illness. Like, it is sometimes going to kill you. Let people die. Let people be finished with this.
Yeah.
You have to stay here and you have to grieve, and that's hard, but it's harder for what this person is going through is harder. So just let them have that. Stop telling them to fight. Stop telling them to be strong. Let them just be sick and miserable a little bit. Do you know what I mean? I think it comes from a good place, but stop putting this on people. Death is a part, like death and illness are a part of life, and you have to like accept a little bit that it's happening. And I just thought that was, it's like the quotes you read too, where it's just, I got to think that's a true thing. And I liked that it's framed from the character in our novel who is going through who's going through the pain and going through the illness of being like, stop telling me that. It makes it seem like this is my fault.
Do you recommend this one?
I do recommend it. And so if you haven't read it yet, or if you've been picking it up thinking about how you don't really like video games and you might not like this book, there's a very good chance that you will like this book, that it is well written and it's a good literary book.
Yeah, I don't need to recommend it as much as everybody in the world has recommended it to you at this point. But for what it's worth, here's two more thumbs up.
Yeah, but I mean,
you should read it.
For what it's worth, this is a good, well-written book.
Okay, what are we doing next? We are doing A Man Called Ove?
We're doing A Man Called Ove. Yeah, that's correct.
Looking forward to that one. That one's going to be a reread for me. But I think I listened to it the first time. So I guess I will read it this time. See if there's...
It's fresh for me, and I've also not seen the movie. So the whole story is fresh for me.
Oh, okay. This is going to be a fun one then. All right. Well, thank you for spending time with us. I know that's your sign off. Sorry. You can follow us, please, on Instagram or Lit Salon, although I don't really update that. Just try Instagram. You can write to us with book suggestions, ideas, thoughts, things we got wrong, so forth, at readingpopclassics@gmail.com.
And thanks for listening.